Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The evidence is everywhere that animals are complex beings. And it just may be time to begin to change the language from which to who when we talk about them. It begins to make a difference. We begin to push the argument and explore a world in which an open communion exists in the fields and forests, terraria, and our household pets. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News. So what of a world where we human animals finally open up to the existence of feelings and emotions in the living beings around us? We continue our discussion now with Dr. Mark Beckhoff. There's so many things. You also have some extraordinary stories about some of the examples of animal sorrow and grief, particularly at the death of a mate or someone in their clan or tribe. What stories stand out for you there? Because that's powerful.
Well, there's so many, but yes. Of course, elephant grief we know about. Elephants just are known for being animals who pay respect to their dead and mourn the loss of their friends. But I've got some really nice stuff in there on grief in llamas, grief in otters. Mm. But once again, you know, you'd expect that. You know, we expect dogs to show grief, which they do, and cats when they lose a friend or when they lose a human, you know, a friend, human or otherwise. But you know what's really just wonderful is that when I put out a call for stories, my friend Betsy Webb, who lives in Homer, Alaska, sent me the llama story. And Scott Coleman, who works down at a feline sanctuary in Texas, sent me one about wolves and one about otters. So once again, if you find joy and you find happiness and fear in other animals, you'll also find grief. It's not hidden grief, if you will. You know, it's real grief.
We can't possibly do justice to your book because it's so rich. But some of it, and that, so I encourage people to read it because it's a joy. But for example, some of it is ritualized. You give any number of examples of animals that have ritualized somehow, or at least that's our interpretation again. I'm calling it ritualized. But anyways, their response, for example, to death. For example, the fox that was burying its mate.
Right down the road from me.
Yeah.
God, no, exactly. That's what she was doing. She wasn't just digging dirt over her partner. She was actually orienting herself, kicking dirt, looking at it, and then purposely orienting herself so that she would be covering her friend out of respect. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And elephants, give some examples of ways in which elephants almost very specifically honor a fallen comrade.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they'll nose them, they'll try to pick them up, like forklift them with their tusks, they'll hang out, they'll do actually a grieving ceremony where each elephant will touch the other elephant. That's how I start my book with the story about magpies. When we were riding into Boulder one day, we saw five magpies, and then we saw a dead one, obviously hit by a car, and we saw two animals go up and peck it with the beak and then fly off and bring grass back. They all hung out as if very silent, and then they all flew off. This was magpie grief. And I also have great examples of gorilla wakes, gorillas having wakes for one another. Mm-hmm. I dedicate my book to two animals, Jasper, a moon bear in China who has been severely abused for his bile by the bear bile industry.
That story is painful to read.
Yeah, it's painful to read. And I also dedicate the book to Pablo. And when Pablo died inside of a prison lab, the other monkeys paid him respect and held a funeral service for him, if you will. Mm-hmm. So once again, you know, like I mentioned before, we now know that mice are empathic beings. There's no reason to think that mice might not feel grief and display some kind of ceremony for fallen mice. You know, we just don't know, Sydney. And one of the exciting things about what I'm doing and why I want to share it is every day something new comes in, And the new information never contradicts what we know, what we intuit. It's really cool.
Well, I consider myself a scientist, and this has been the challenge, that my sense of observation as a field biologist and an ethologist on a to whatever level I do that tells me without any sort of doubt that these are realities in our world, and it's my mission. I am on a mission, because I said I consider this to be the most important thing that we can do right now on planet Earth, is to open up our awareness about the sentience of all of the other creatures out there, to whatever degree they have it, okay?
Right.
But they are aware. There's much more complex. There's a full panoply of different ways in which they are expressing their beingness. And I guess part of my message is the fact that, personally, why I think it's so important, is that I feel that we are missing out on such unlimited, almost infinite joy and a sense of wonder that transcends even where we are now, because we have that limitation. That if we're able to open up and realize as we take a walk outside that virtually every creature that we see, every single one has some sense of this beingness, and they're living out their life, and that if we can take the time to listen to them as they're trying to share this with us, that if we open to that, we are enriched tremendously. It's critical. It's my mission.
Exactly. And I think one of the important things that we must recognize is that I do it in my book, and other people who are writing about animal emotions are showing, is that it's not just a bunch of loose anthropomorphism. It's not just a bunch of fluff because I live in Boulder, Colorado. It's real. Science has data, mirror neurons, spindle cells, empathy in mice, a large hippocampus in elephants who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. It's just not a lot. It's just not fluff. And I'm tired of hearing people go, oh, you're being sentimental. Oh, you're being anthropomorphic. No, I'm being scientific.
Right.
And they don't like they don't like to recognize that, because it means if they do, then there's going to be a lot that they can't continue doing to other animals in invasive research and in the food industry and in research and education and entertainment. So
it makes it a lot easier to take out whole forests, doesn't it?
It is.
I mean, if you think about a forest and you think about all the creatures in a particular habitat, if you take out a forest and you don't have to think about those creatures, it just makes it a lot easier. I myself, you make the point that you have become a vegetarian for all the reasons that we're discussing here. And I myself have been a vegetarian an ancient long time ago. I'm not now. And I'll just be perfectly honest. The reason I'm not is I can't think about what I'm really doing.
Uh-huh.
I just as a human being, I have a I don't know that I can really go there if I think about these creatures and the fact that they are feeling beings. But here's one of the things that I think is, from a scientific perspective, is really interesting. And that is that, okay, we're talking about the fact that these animals have these ways of showing their emotions. And one scientific approach would be, well, that's how they communicate within their species. But I am prepared to say, and this opens up this topic of what this is really about and how we can gain, is that these animals as well communicate that interspecially, for that they're communicating within their community, feelings on an individual basis, and that other animals perceive it, get it, grok it, understand it, sense it, and respond to it. And it enriches our sense of what's really going on out there in our world, and that's the fact that there's a tremendous passion of life in every community.
Of course it goes on interspecifically between species. One, of course, is we know it goes on between us and other species, including our dogs. But there's no doubt that a wolf knows how a dog feels. I mean, you know, I think we may, in the beginning, have to understand that we need to concentrate on closely related species who have similar communication patterns. Oh, but I guarantee you, over time, we're going to learn that these animals communicate with one another in very deep and meaningful ways across species. I was just in India a couple of months ago, and a guy told me that he believes that where whales and other cetaceans and elephants come together, when elephants go to the water to drink, they communicate using infrasound, that very low sound. I mean, that's amazing.
It is.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, well, I think quite honestly, I'm prepared to say that it's an open system. I'm not putting any limits anymore on what I think is being communicated amongst the creatures. I'm saying it's an open system. I mean, you take any two animals in a household, whether it's a gerbil or and a dog, and you'll find them playing.
Exactly.
You know, getting along, and the dog will be protective of that animal, the dog or a cat. Or a bird. You just name whatever, put whatever matrix you want. Now you gotta be a little careful with cats and birds sometimes.
Yes, but you know, in the book I point out that there's a couple of examples where a lioness in Africa adopted a baby oryx
exactly.
on five different occasions.
Exactly.
A
right.
predatory snake who eats hamsters has a hamster friend
yes.
who is allowed to sit on his back while he eats other hamsters.
Now, let's talk about that. Now we're getting to somewhere, because you see, that is a communication amongst two beings across species, but they're communicating something.
Well, you know what? They are, but I don't know what. And, you know, I've been asked this question so many times. I have no idea in the world why that snake likes that hamster. But it could be she has a unique smell. I mean, I don't know, and I think when we call them, I call them improbable friends, improbable relationships. You're right, Sydney. Something is happening, and it may be something unique. But what it points out to me is the infinite possibilities. The hippopotamus who has adopted a baby hippopotamus who's adopted a 100-year-old tortoise as his best friend. After he was basically isolated from his family during the tsunami and then was stranded. Why in the world should, you know, a hippopotamus who, I've seen them in the wild, they're extremely emotional and extremely expressive, adopt a tortoise as his best friend? Not that the tortoise isn't friendly, but more the tortoise doesn't communicate like, you know, they very few facial expressions. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it's an open system. I think it's there's a lot of people I don't like. Okay?
Yeah,
we don't
yeah.
get along, you know? And it very often happens because I look in their eye and something is communicated to me and I say, I don't want to go here, you know?
Right.
I don't need to waste my time here. I think it's an open system, and any two creatures can learn to communicate. And I think obviously the fundamental baseline is the fact that they've agreed to get along.
Exactly.
They've agreed that they're not going to hurt each other.
Yes. But we don't know how. I would love to see someone systematically study what
yes.
we call these improbable relationships.
I think that's an area of science that needs to be explored wide open.
Yeah, it'll blow people's minds. I'm afraid, but I bet you some people are afraid. It'll bring things out, and it'll blow their minds in terms of the subtlety of
inter-specific
yes. communication,
yes.
and it'll blow their doors off in terms of how subtle and how ubiquitous this friendship is. And that, of course, goes into, you know, what I've written in a number of books, including the one I wrote with Jane Goodall, that there's a great umbrella of compassion.
Yes.
And that really the world is one. We're all going to be knit together in this umbrella of compassion and love. And I know people say, oh, God, you only say that because you live in Boulder, Colorado.
No.
And I go, nope. I really believe it, man.
Yeah.
I really believe
yeah.
that when we open up our hearts to these animals, we're going to discover friends as the world has never known.
You talk about in your book the mirror neurons, which are a unique phenomenon that you're beginning to discover, which indicate the possibly the portal through which there is this empathy. Give us a short entree to that.
Right. Well, mirror neurons were discovered about 10 years ago by accident. When a monkey reaches for a pencil, say, what you see is certain neurons fire in his prefrontal cortex. And one night, a graduate student, this was a lab in Italy, one night a graduate student went in, and while he was in the lab, they had it set up so that when the neurons fire, there's a sound that comes off from the recorder. So, you know, it's a crackling sound, but it's very common.
Mm-hmm.
He heard the neurons of the monkey fire when he reached for a pencil. So when you and then, of course, there's been a ton of study. There was an essay in Time magazine back in January, which was, you know, basically one of the clearest reviews of what we're learning in neurobiology and behavior. They said that mirror neurons will do for psychology what DNA did for molecular biology. Mm. And what they were saying was that it's very important to recognize that there are ways now where animals can share emotions and share intentions. So the way it might work would be, when I do a play bow, my play bow neurons fire, and I know what I feel. When you do a play bow, my mirror neurons for play bow fire, and I have an idea of what you feel and what you want.
There's some sort of communication.
Yeah, it's right. There's a sharing of intention. There's this knowledge of what's in your head. And so, once again, when I say I can feel the pain of a dog, I can. And it's probably mediated by some system like mirror neurons. Mm-hmm. If I say I feel your pain, I feel your joy, I feel your grief, there's a neural or material basis. So what the discovery of mirror neurons has done across the board is it's really taken into the realm of science the notion of empathy, the sharing of feelings. The way you put it, that, you know, these mirror neurons are sort of portals of empathy, that's really a great way to put it. That's, of course, what probably underlies the empathy in mice. So, you know, once again, if we have mirror neurons and great apes have mirror neurons and monkeys have mirror neurons, so do dogs, cats, and rats have a functional equivalent, just like the spindle cells that were thought to be only in humans and great apes are now for sure in whales, and I'll bet you if we look for them in other species, we'll find them.
I'm going to go way out on a limb here, but I'm going to share some of my research as an ethologist fieldwork. And one of the things that you mentioned is the fact that in the various different emotions, one of them that is not expressed too much in the scientific realms that are being investigated right now is love. Although you do actually talk about that in your book. Let me just share this concept. What I work with when I go out, I try to figure out how is it that I can communicate with animals on a more open system. Where can I go? What's that common denominator? And I'll say that this is what I do. When I head out and I'm trying to do field research in the wild, and I come across a creature, all that I can say is this is what I've been working with, and that is that I send out a sense of love. Now, almost everybody can understand what that really means, but I really push it out there. I really try to communicate a sense to that animal that mm-hmm. I love them, that I care about them, that they're my friend, that they're safe, this is a sanctuary, that I'm happy to be with them. That's just what I send out. And I'm telling you, I've had miraculous experiences across the board with rabbits that in the wild, and I send that out, and the next thing you know, and this, you know, this is emotional for me, they relax, they're grooming, they're just hanging out with me.
It's likely that they may use visual cues, but it's probably more likely that you're not stressed and you're not giving off a stress odor or a stress pheromone.
Well, I'm going to say that it may be that my mirror neurons are somehow communicating with their mirror neurons in some way that we can't explain, just like we can't really explain how in the world a cell phone works unless you get it. You know?
Right, but let me say that people now are beginning to investigate mirror neurons in modalities other than vision. So what you're saying is perfectly on the mark from a scientific point of view.
Right. That's where I'm experimenting.
There's just no reason to think there might not be olfactory or odor mirror neurons.
Yes. Yeah.
Like I said, Sydney, I could not have picked a better area of research 35 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had no idea where it would go, but I honestly believed that if, in fact, it went in the way that I, quote, felt it would go, then we were going to really make some incredible discoveries when we learn the techniques like, you know, functional magnetic resonance imaging and PET scans.
Yes.
And when people did the behavioral work. Mm-hmm. One thing that people don't understand is it's really hard. I write in my book about collecting elephant poop, for example, or moving yellow snow. I mean, yeah, that's cute, and it sounds cute, but it's hard work, but it's a non-invasive way to learn about the lives of these animals, and that's what I love.
the book is rich in these stories. That's it's a gift, and I'm not just saying that. Obviously, I'm passionate about this, and we share a very, very similar quest. But now let's talk about how this applies then as we start to look at some of the hard issues. For example, laboratory animals, captive animals in zoos. Not to give these people a hard time, but to say we need to be aware. We need to start really exploring what really may be going on with these creatures, because in many cases they may be experiencing things that we're just not prepared to think about.
Yeah, of course the subtitle ends with, you know, a leading scientist explores animal joy, sorrow, and empathy and why they matter. The reason emotions matter is because animals have feelings and animals have a perspective on the world. They have preferences like we do. They have likes and dislikes like we do. And it matters because we shouldn't be causing intentional harm to these animals. And the discovery that mice are empathic beings is an interesting one, because mice and other rodents and birds are not protected under the Federal Animal Welfare Act. If you read the Federal Animal Welfare Act carefully, you will notice that mice, rats, rabbits, for example, rodents, are actually not animals.
Yes.
It's not a false reading. It is a true reading of the Federal Animal Welfare Act in America, that these are not considered to be animals.
That's nuts.
It's nuts. So then you think about keeping, that it's legal to keep a chimpanzee in a basically a 5x5x7 cage. I mean, my goodness gracious.
Yeah.
You know, so the reason they matter and the implications are huge. And then, of course, you know, we get all upset about animals in rodeos and circuses and in education and research. But if you want to make a difference in this world, you got to pay attention to what's happening to animals in factory farming and mass murder. I call them weapons of mass destruction, slaughterhouses. About at least 50,000 animals a minute are slaughtered. And somebody told me my math might actually have been wrong, but regardless, it's an incalculable number of animals slaughtered per minute and per hour.
As you say in the book, this is not going to change suddenly.
It's
impossible. We do have to be open to the fact that we may be doing things consciously that we're not consciously aware of the effects, and it's important for us to do that. I believe that once we begin to embrace this concept about, really, really embrace, and children and their families and people around the world, as many people do, understand that these creatures, any of those creatures in those laboratories, you take them out of that laboratory and you decide that it's your pet, and all of those emotions are suddenly available. And that's the hard part, because quite honestly, every single one of those creatures has the capacity to have all of those feelings and emotions. I don't know where we're going to go with that,
yep.
But it's a challenge.
Right, and that's just a great way to put it. Why do they become available in situations where, you know, when we're not in the lab?
Yes.
No, it's really important. And, you know, more and more people are focusing on these questions because, number one, no one wants to do intentional harm, or very few people do, and we don't need to deal with them now. However, most people want to add compassion and love to the world. But, you know, what we missed is the huge reason, if you will, even, quote, putting ethics aside, which, of course, we can, is better data are collected when we are working with less stressed animals. And scientists now across the world are concerned that so much information has been collected on animals who are stressed. And so if there's no reason other than to increase the reliability of scientific data, then we shouldn't stress or cause intentional harm or, you know, unnecessary pain.
And as well, the scientific approaches to this research are becoming more elegant and less invasive, less destructive.
Absolutely.
Techniques are emerging, and those, again, are choices.
Absolutely. You know what it is? What it really comes down to are the choices we make, and we need to be responsible for the choices. Simple. Individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
Either own your responsibility. You know, most people don't hesitate to take credit for something, so they also need to take responsibility when they do things that could harm other animals or the environment.
Well, Mark Beckhoff, author, researcher, ethologist, fellow Earth traveler here who was on a mission to try to bring this awareness of the animal creatures and their richness as beings. Also the author of The Emotional Lives of Animals. Mark, for people who want to learn more about this, and where would you suggest that they head?
Well, of course I could say read my book.
Well, that's a given. I'll endorse
that.
In
all honesty, where they could head is, you know, if you go to the web and you just punch in animal emotions, you'll get a lot of hits. But I think where they could really head would be, if you will, I like where they could head, is they should head into their hearts. They should look at what we know and accept the fact fully that we know enough right now that we have to call for a major, major change in the way we treat non-human animals across the board.
Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is the fact that humans actually get it. Most humans do, because I think you give the statistic that well over 50% of the households in America have pets.
Of course, there's no excuse. Anyone who lives with a dog or a cat or even a bird knows all this.
Yeah.
No, really, Sydney, I mean, you hit it on the head so many times and you just hit it on the head again. These people know exactly what they're doing and what these animals are feeling.
And that's the basis where we have to look for our science, is what actually the field research, which happens in every home across America, is telling us, and as well farms and other places where animals share their space with humans.
Exactly.
Always good to talk with you, Mark, Dr. Mark Beckhoff. If people want to find out more about your research...
Well, I'll probably just go to my homepage, which is probably the first hit under Google. I don't remember it. Jane Goodall and I founded an organization called Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And that's a place where I suggest people go, because scientists, other researchers, non-researchers, students, veterinarians, just interested people have posted stuff there, and it's available in the archive, and that's where you can find an incredible amount of information about animal emotions, animal cognition, and humane research.
Well, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, we're going to be working together for years ahead here.
Well, thank you.
I always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you, Sydney. I look forward to chatting with you again.
Between now and the next show, take the time to listen. You just may open doors of perception that will amaze you, teach you, and bring you a lifetime of a deepening sense of truth. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when the voices of the earth call out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.
Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand?